You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we do the five extra reps if it makes it easier to climb the steps. When it comes to matters of quality of life, I'll never understand why some people's first instinct is to cut corners. At some point or another, you're going to have to pay the bill for your choices, and that bill is going to be a lot higher in the long run if you never take the time to do something right. You see, that is what's really at stake when I talk about cutting corners: the ability to focus. If you cut a corner today, you'll be forced to walk the rest of the way tomorrow. And tomorrow is when you'll be trying to work on something else. So ultimately, by trying to save time on one thing, you've lost time on multiple things. Such an erroneous strategic approach is, ironically, the quickest way to not get anything done. If you want to do something, do it right the first time to establish a strong foundation. It's a lot quicker, cheaper, and easier to maintain something than it is to keep rebuilding it from the ground up. Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
I'm fine, just reporting from the corner-cutting capital of the world.
Yeah, that Washington, D.C. Sort of a suppressed premise of my argument here, as you'll see from the episode titled The Desalination Edition, which we will address here in a few moments.
Oh my, do they love to cut the corners here! Not just the corners, but the side streets and the alleys and everything else. And just say, fuck it, we'll take a helicopter.
Isn't there a whole show about that that you enjoy watching?
The West Wing?
Well, I was going to say the other one.
I know. I'm rewatching The West Wing because I was so depressed by House of Cards being so shitty.
And now you're depressed by The West Wing?
Well, no. I mean, The West Wing's a very, very different kind of House of Cards. It's actually an aspirational kind, even though they are radically and dramatically left, but it's still quite good.
Just let us know when you get to the Penn and Teller episode.
I love that episode.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. What's it like to be back on the grid, Elliot? We saw that last week. You even took the podcast off, so you went completely off the grid.
Yeah, I had a little emergency last week, but it's good to be back and kind of plugged into the world a little bit more. Of course, I just can't get over the irony that the week I'm back on social media is when all this shit going on in Indiana starts hitting the fan. It's nothing I haven't said before, so I'll just make one brief comment. And that's, you really learn a lot about the immaturity from social justice warriors, because the whole point, I think, of being a social justice warrior is worrying about what other people think. I'm at a point now in my life, and I think most people listening are at least working to get to that point, where we really don't care what other people, particularly strangers, think of us.
Wait. I just want to stop you here for a second. I hope the listeners at least care what we think.
Oh, yeah. You guys should totally care what we think. And vote us, upvote us on iTunes, of course. But I mean, it's just the whole premise of being these kind of activists is, it's the idea that, you know, other people might not like us. Other people might hate us. And I'm at the point now where I'm totally fine with that. You want to hate me? Go ahead. You want to hate us, to hate the podcast? Go ahead. But honestly, it doesn't matter. It betrays their immaturity. They really just need to grow up. People are going to hate you for a whole bunch of reasons. And even more complicating truth is that people might not hate you. They might agree with a lot of the things that you do or say, but that doesn't mean that they hate you either. So, and you have to deal with it. Just deal with it. Not everyone, life is not all people getting along singing kumbaya.
And just to add to that point a little bit, I think once you get over the idea that there's a few people out there that hate you, you find out there's actually far fewer people that hate you than you think.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree with that.
I think there's an even deeper irony here that a friend of mine, Luke, pointed out. Shout out to Luke. Which is that, what are the social justice warriors actually fighting for? what is their preferred conclusion in this Indiana religious freedoms battle or in any of these kind of battles? It's the ability to give your money to people who hate you. The outcome you want is to financially support people you proclaim are bigots.
Isn't that the ultimate form of altruism?
So congratulations, definitely, social justice warriors. You are egalitarian to the moronic extreme.
Yeah, primacy of equality over liberty. That's really what it is when it comes to the political point of view.
All right, well, that is good use of the force of logic by Luke. And now we are going to turn to someone who does not have a good grasp on the force of logic in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Another thing that's been in the news this week, aside from Indiana, is the state of California, who is not dealing so much with social justice issues, so much as with a lack of water, or so I'm told. Did anyone actually inform the governor that his entire state borders the Pacific Ocean? I just want to mention that. You're welcome, Jerry Brown. Anyway, the Investors Business Daily had a fantastic editorial this week titled, California Drought, What Scarce is Wisdom, Not Water. So they start off, California is so dry the Governor Jerry Brown has instituted water use restrictions for the first time in the state's history. Problem, though, is that there is not a shortage of water. It's a shortage of thinking. The article goes on to point out that the kind of restrictions that Jerry Brown is talking about are Soviet-style restrictions. We have this thing that everyone needs, so what we need to do is control it, restrict it, give people less of it so that we can conserve it indefinitely. When what we really need, and what California needs, what the world needs, is a market solution to this problem. Let people buy and trade it and don't subsidize it, don't regulate it, make it a product, and you'll find soon there will be an abundance of this thing, in this case water, and it will be cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But of course, no one thought of this years ago, so now California is stuck in a terrible drought. What say you, gentlemen?
Doesn't California just need more attention from the rest of the country? Because aren't they very dry because no one really pays attention to them the way they used to anymore?
How droll you are. Such biting wit and satire.
God, that was good!
They're as dry as the Merlot that they produce, that's what I said.
Oh, God. It's this entire issue brings up something that we have been shouting out on this show collectively since its inception, which is desalinate the motherfucking ocean.
Wait, what does Christopher Nolan have to do about this?
Desalinate the fucking ocean. That's what he has to do with it.
Well, and that's a market solution, right?
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's already going on a smallish scale. I think I looked up, there are 14 desalination plants in the state of California who produce water that is roughly 2.1 or 2.5 times as expensive as fresh water. But the thing is, there's one thing I posted a picture on Facebook this week of the ocean and suggested that California didn't actually have a water shortage. And people said that, California's water isn't drinkable, or ocean water isn't drinkable for various number of reasons, which led me to believe, do people think that all of the non-salt water is just readily drinkable out of wherever it is? Do they not understand that it also goes through a process where it is filtered and made drinkable, made ready for human consumption? Do people honestly think that we just stick a hose in the ground and then suck it out of the ground? Is that really what people think?
Yeah, I think some people do think that. Like, who was it? Like, yeah, I think, I'm sure there are people who do.
But you try that and then get dysentery.
But it's funny, who was it that said that famous quote now about if the government was put in charge of the Sahara in 10 years, there would be a shortage of sand? This is
Friedman.
A perfect example of that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. When you put the government in charge of a product, there will be shortages and it will be more expensive and less available. Now, I'd like to ask you, gentlemen. Oh, go ahead, Justin, then I'll ask you.
There's a greater point here, and maybe I'm going to answer your question here. There's a greater point here. I mean, we can go off all day about government and government intervention being inept, but there's a greater point of ineptitude here. So you made the point that desalinized water, when you go through these plants, is about 2 times more expensive than normal water, correct? Yes.
Correct.
But how much of the normal water do we have right now?
How much? What yes. do you mean?
We have none of the normal water
okay,
right now.
Okay, I see we're in a drought. Right. Correct.
So you can pay double the price to have something, or zero of that price to have nothing. And if it's something that's essential, just pay double the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you say that, but poor people couldn't afford water. I was doing research on this, and I'll tell you what the numbers are here.
I was going to say, how much is it going to cost for water? Because if it's less than a gallon of gas, I'm going to flip shit. If desalinized water is less than a gallon of gas, I'm going to flip shit. You're just going to hear me throwing shit all over this apartment.
You'll be like a rhesus monkey in a cage.
Exactly. I was picturing literal shit flying all over the room.
So the average American consumes in one way or another, via showers, cleaning, eating, drinking, 100 gallons of water per day. The cost of that in purely desalinated water terms is 29 cents per day.
Wait. It would cost me 29 cents a day to not have a water drought anymore.
Okay, now, no, it would cost you more because that's what it costs in just and general energy terms to produce that. So obviously they would have to charge you more. But let's say they charge you, 70 cents a day.
What if they charge me a dollar? That's more than double the price.
There you go. They charge you a dollar a day for your water consumption, the average person. Not bad, right?
And that's all it would cost, a dollar a day.
That's what it currently costs with the desalination methods right now. Now, if this was put on a mass scale and actually the market functions were at work to make it cheaper, because the water wasn't subsidized, it would get cheaper and cheaper.
People are saying this is too expensive when it would cost a dollar a day for something I need to live.
Yes.
If I don't have water, I die without it, and I can't afford to give someone a dollar a day to keep me alive. That's what they're saying. So their lives, they value their lives less than a dollar a day.
Yes, absolutely. Shit has been flipped!
He literally flipped shit. That was great.
You know what I just threw? That was my Penn and Teller Bill of Rights, okay? That's what they are doing.
That's why it clanged.
This is what they are doing. That's what they are doing.
Yeah. That's about right.
But that's how a creep like Jerry Brown gets into office in the first place, really. God, I mean, he was so creepy. When he talks about how, so you're not going to get to water your little green lawns as much as you'd like and blah, 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 blah. I'm just reading those quotes and it's just frightening. I mean, it's creepy. Absolutely creepy. But you're right.
This is exactly why he thinks he needs to be there, because people need him to make the tough decisions to make sure that their lives go on.
It's a tough decision.
No one needs
him. It's a tough decision to pay a dollar to live. That's a tough decision.
Apparently, yes.
It's a dollar. It's a dollar to live.
Look, if you're brilliant enough to turn your own pee into urine and you can market that, then that's fine. But pay the damn dollar if you're
so
not.
Let me ask you guys, because I've actually tried to think this through, and I can't think of why this isn't a comparable example. The government doesn't provide food for us. We have to pay for our own food. I mean, it's sort of quasi-subsidized, like corn is subsidized in some areas, and we do pay farmers certain amounts. But in general, there is a market in food, certainly much more than there is in water.
Well, this is the perception thing you were talking about, where people think they can stick a straw in the ground and drink it, and it'll be fine. They think that water just... It's the same thing with internet. We're talking about how they're going to do net neutrality. They think internet just exists, so
the government
can regulate it.
10 years from now, they can recycle this article and just take out water and put in bandwidth.
Yeah.
It's going to be the same thing. There isn't enough bandwidth for everyone, so we're going to have to start restricting our internet access because there just isn't enough bandwidth to go about.
And I'll be throwing the Bill of Rights around as well, because you could have had internet for a dollar a day, which we do have right now.
Get yourself a boomerang, Justin, so that when you throw shit, it comes back
to
you. So
for $2 a day, you can get both water and internet. Mm-hmm. Tremendous.
And then, really, it's $10 a day you can live. Because you can go to McDonald's and get a double cheeseburger for $2. So you can live for $10 a day in America, okay?
It's true, absolutely. So the other element of this, which sort of ties in with our theme, is not like, even if Jerry Brown said tomorrow, okay, we're going to have a free market in water. It's not going to solve this problem immediately. But that's because politics has no long-range thinking, necessarily, because all they're trying to do is solve the problem in the moment so they can get reelected or move to a higher office.
Right, they're just trying to solve the problem of votes. That's it.
Yes, which is why we absolutely must have the market solve these problems, because the market is the exact opposite. Well, not opposite, but it includes the future. It is necessarily long-term because it wants to stay in business for a long time. So it has to solve these problems. Anything that we see as essential that we need in our lives all the time, we should want a market solution, because they're going to be the ones that are going to provide it for cheaper, longer, and better.
So you just convinced me to legalize prostitution.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Fuck yeah, cheaper, longer, better. Yeah. Oh, free the BJ. Yeah. I don't understand. Desalinate the fucking oceans.
$1 a day. For $1 a day, you can help Justin have a healthy water source. For only $1 a day, Sally Struther. Please.
I'm afraid she would eat the children. So speaking of things that are either long-term or short-term, depending on your point of view, a new study suggests that men get attached romantically more easily than women. Researchers behind a new survey from Match.com seem to think that men are showing a much more feminine quality nowadays in being attached first with women. 54% of guys say that they felt love at first sight, compared to 44% of women. Guys are also less interested in having time to themselves away from their significant other. 77% of women say having personal space is very important, compared to just 58% of men. And this is a bizarre one to me. Only 23% of guys think it's crucial to have regular nights out with their pals, as opposed to 35% of ladies. So the argument here is that men are now expressing some traditional female attitudes while women are adopting more attributes that are associated with men. So the question becomes, is this a cultural thing that we're just sort of seeing a change in, or is this a long-term thing that we're just revealing?
What do you mean by long-term thing we're just revealing?
Is this something that has always been the case and that we're just getting the data now to show this, as opposed to like our preconceived notions about it?
I kind of think that, you know, I read a few years ago this study that talked about how even though men are more likely to cheat on their partners, on their girlfriends, women are actually more likely to leave their husbands and their families for somebody else. So men are more likely to have a one-night stand or like a brief affair, but they're not going to leave their wives and their kids. Women are more likely to do that. So this kind of ties into that a little bit. I think men do get attached a lot more. So even if they do stray physically or biologically, you know, they're less likely to walk away from a relationship into which they've invested a long time.
But that goes in the face of what they're saying in this article by saying traditional feminine and masculine qualities, because that's what you're saying, Elliot, is the man doesn't take the physicality as emotionally. Where they're saying that females traditionally do that, but now they're saying in this article that men do take the physicality more emotionally. Am I correct, Daniel?
I think so. I mean, the article is definitely trying to make the argument, and this is an article in Marie Claire, by the way. They're definitely trying to make the argument that this is a cultural change in men. And they're seeing it as a good thing, of course. Mm-hmm. So
I don't think it's much of a change. I think men have always, in some way, shape, or form, I don't think that they've really ever not been, you know, invested in relationships and stuff like that. And I mean, I think that, I don't know, it says like it's a new trend, but just judging from some of the men in my life, you know, my father, my uncles, you know, my family, my friends, they're very closely committed to the people that they love. And they're the embodiment of this. But I think that they've always pretty much been what the article's describing.
But here's the difference. I think it is cultural, and here's the difference. I think it has to do with now that women don't have as much respect for men. And what I mean by that is, it used to be that the man could give all that attention to the woman and she'd always be there. But nowadays, women are less committed. So it makes men want to be, I don't want to say that it makes them want to be more committed, but it makes them value the time with the woman more. It's a market scarcity issue thing. Where if you have so many women around you and they're all rejecting you and you're not getting time with any of them, when you finally get one, you're going to be like, I don't want you to go anywhere ever. And I'm not saying that's a healthy response, but it's a logical response.
So your argument, or at least the way you're seeing this is that this is a recent cultural development, or so you think.
Yeah, I think it has to do with the heightened disposability of males. So now males aren't only seen as disposable in the sense that their job is to protect the woman and be the provider, but they're also disposable in the sense that women don't take men's desires and feelings seriously because they think there's always another one knocking on the door, because they think there's always, you know, 80 guys after them at a time, 80 worthwhile guys after them at a time. So they're just kind of like, whatever, and they don't take guys as seriously, which of course is going to change the way guys interact. Guys will go one of two ways. They'll either become even douchier players, or they'll become, I mean, these are the two stereotypes, right? The white knight nice guy, and then the, you know, the player type. So those are the two extremes the guys will become.
Yeah.
Either the Ted Mosbys or the Barney Stinsons.
Yeah, I didn't watch that
show.
Wow,
you just made that show a lot more interesting than it was. Wish you didn't give that show that much credit. But yeah, that's probably why that show was so successful for such a long time, because it was trying to balance those two extremes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. I've always been, when I finally fall in love with someone, for me, I always felt it very strongly. Like, I had attraction to people when I dated them, but when I fell in love with someone, when I had that experience, it was always very, hard, I guess, or a deep attachment, if you will.
Crazy.
Maybe I'm a product of this. I don't know. It's hard to get outside myself, but it's very interesting. The study also, had a few other interesting tidbits here. I don't know if you read the sort of quasi footnotes at the end.
Yeah.
Contrary to popular belief, plenty of people become friends first before they fall in love. 71% fell in love with someone they did not initially find attractive after having great conversations or shared interests. And 35% fell in love with someone even though they felt no spark initially.
I mean, those footnotes just reveal some of the biggest bullshit cultural myths there are, right? The spark thing. There's no spark. What is this, a fucking romantic comedy? Like, in reality, you find people you like, you spend time with them, and then you find out you like them more. I mean, don't you ever watch a show, and now, yes, I'm comparing relationships to TV shows, but you watch the first few episodes, and you're like, eh, this is okay, but there are positives here, and then you keep watching it, and it gets better, and you fall in love with the show?
Is that the same thing?
Really? It's similar. You get the point I'm making, though.
Well, it's all about values. It's about getting to know the person. And the more you get to know them, the more the qualities are that you love. So there's less importance on physical attraction or sexual chemistry at first than there was at first, because you're actually finding out other things about the person that makes them incredible value to you.
But chemistry and physical attraction comes from learning those things about someone. This idea of a spark is like this mystical notion that you're just going to meet someone and be like, I love you. I love you too. Let's get married and stay together forever.
Well, I think a spark, and it really and truly, is nothing more than just lust. I think it's that whole, you know, I want to take you to bed and just ravage you kind of thing.
And I think that's giving too much credit to people who use the spark argument.
I think that's the only thing it could possibly refer to agree with Elliot a little bit. But yes, I do think that. And that people, we do this with careers as well, which is, oh, when you find someone, you'll know it. Or when you're doing the work you're supposed to be doing in life, you'll just know it. No, you won't just fucking know it. You have to think about it. To figure it out.
Well, and ironically, that's how the other myth that they're talking about happens. That's how the friend zone thing happens, right? This quote unquote friend zone that supposedly exists, and guys get stuck in the friend zone and blah, blah, blah. You know how you get stuck in the friend zone? You're not aware of your own desires, the fact that you're actualizing it in reality.
Hmm.
If some girl only sees you as not a full person, they only see you as like half a person, so it's basically they don't see you as a person with sexual desires. You've allowed yourself to be seen that way, or you've allowed to associate yourself with a psychopath or someone with serious issues. So either way, you've made a serious error. Agree, disagree.
Rethink your life, mofo. Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't thought about
it that
thoroughly. I guess. Give me 10 seconds. Jesus.
No, agree.
Let my brain work.
That's a soft agree.
Yes,
I'll
you
take
are
it.
Right in or all
they,
things.
They could have Asperger's. You never know.
It's true. Or autism. Speaking of autism.
Wow, great work, Elliot.
Thank you. So we just had a new theory of male-female relationships, and now we're going to talk about a new theory of autism. A groundbreaking study suggests people on the autism spectrum, such as Asperger's, do not lack empathy. Rather, they feel others' emotions too intensely to cope. The idea is called the intense world theory, and it's posited by Henry and Camilla Markram of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And they suggest that the fundamental problem in autism spectrum disorders is not a social deficiency, but rather a hypersensitivity to experience, which includes an overwhelming fear response, encapsulated in this kind of quote, "I can walk into a room and feel what everyone is feeling. The problem is that it all comes in faster than I can process it." So speaking as someone who knows quite little about autism other than the quasi-derogatory sounding, "that guy is on the spectrum," I have no idea what to say about this. It makes logical sense to me, but I have no way to check this against reality. Do either of you have any further insight?
That's okay that you don't, because I have two things to say about this.
Right.
The first is, if you look at autism, what is it characterized by when people are high on the spectrum? They have difficulty with sensory overload. You know, certain fabrics rub on them the wrong way and it makes them freak out. Certain sounds, certain lights cause them to freak out. So why wouldn't the same thing be true of perceiving other people's emotions? That's just another form of perception, being able to read body language, being able to read the way people are talking.
You just made an a fortiori argument. Well done, sir.
What's that?
If this less likely thing is true, then this more likely thing is likely to be true.
All right, well, I'm going to do that same logic again. Are you ready for my second
yeah!
point?
Yeah! I love rhetoric.
Okay, so we know that there are different types of intelligence, right? For instance, I'm just better with words. I've been since I was young. So certain people's brains are just, they have the genetics, and their brains are made up in a way that they're better at that, or better at certain things.
Granted.
Okay, so why do we say that people who are smarter have lower emotional IQs and people who are dumber have higher emotional IQs? Now, I know that sounds relatively simple, but what I'm saying is we say that low IQs, low intelligence, means higher emotional intelligence, and lower or higher IQs, higher intelligence, means lower emotional intelligence. That does not make sense at all. What if the reason people who are super smart have trouble interacting with people is because they don't let as much go as people who are dumb? Because the people who are dumb just don't pick up shit. But the people who are smart, they pick up on the little social slights or the little discomforts that other people don't pick up.
So what you're saying is that people who are dumb are also numb.
Yes, exactly. I think that would be a great way to say it. And that's why they have, it's the alcohol principle. Why do smarter people tend to drink more and tend to smoke weed more to try and socially interact? Because you're numbing yourself. Well, what if the reason dumber people have an easier time socially interacting is because they're naturally numb?
Naturally drunk?
In the same sense that they're naturally not as good with numbers or words or whatever other skill. Do you get the point I'm making?
Yes. This is the Justin making himself to be superior to everyone in the human race theory.
Now. I'm not Ayn Rand only writing a book about people. But yes, if I'm going to write stories, they're going to be about how awesome people are.
That's a very good way to put it.
That was a Party Down reference.
Oh. Really?
Yeah,
really?
They talk about Ayn Rand. So some guy's trying to read Atlas Shrugged to impress a girl, and he goes up to Lizzie Kaplan's character, and he's like, "Have you ever heard of Ayn Rand?" And she said, "Yes, Ayn Rand wrote about how awesome people are," which I was like, that's a pretty good way to put objectivism. And
wait a minute.
Positive.
Wait a minute. We're going to get back to autism. There is that deep of an Ayn Rand reference in Party Down?
Dude, Party Down is one of the smartest shows to air in like the last decade.
I couldn't get through two episodes.
Well, you missed out.
I must be dumb. Anyway.
Or numb.
Okay, back to autism. Back to autism. I don't regularly deal with people who are on the spectrum. I can't even think of one person I've had any sort of close relationship with who I would describe that way.
Incorrect.
Really?
Yes.
I know we have a mutual friend, someone who did appear on the show every so often as the Doctor in the Lost season one of of this podcast. But you would really describe him as being on the spectrum.
Yes, he is. He said he is. He self-identifies as that.
Is that like self-identifying as cisgender?
I don't know. He says he exhibits qualities of it. And I mean, at the very least, I think he's an example of one of these people who feels things so intensely. And because of that, people say he has low emotional IQ, but he's actually a genius. So I actually just think he understands more socially, but people had trouble teaching him that. So he never learned the coping skills because think about it. How hard is it to train a Tom Brady to be a star quarterback if you're not also a star quarterback? Well,
Did you time that?
if you're that smart emotionally, how hard is it to train you to be able to cope with it if somebody else, the person training you, isn't that able?
Yeah, it's interesting.
No, that's interesting. I have two of my closest friends are both on the spectrum in different degrees. And I was reading this thing, and it's the article, and it sounds a lot like them in a lot of ways, because there are times where they both, it's really difficult, especially if you're on the spectrum and you're working at a place like Disney, where you're, especially like right now during spring break, you're bombarded with a lot of people. So I've learned a lot just from my interactions with them, with my friends, because they've kind of like had their little moments of like, okay, I need to get away from this for a while. And, I think a lot of it is a bit impulsive. I think that a lot of their issues, and particularly with their anxiety, it's not really something that they have control over. It's more like it's just kind of this automated response in their brain that they really can't process until they step away from the situation for a while.
It's information overload. What happens when any device you have gets too much information? It shuts down. I mean, think about when you have too much pain. What do? You go into a shock response.
No, I just lift more.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, if your tools, right? So your eyes, your nose, your mouth, all of them, your ears.
Penis, yes.
Your penis. No, I was talking about the five senses. But
you
all
said
of
tools.
Them, yeah, I know. All okay. of them take in more information than a normal person. They're set to a higher threshold. It makes sense that it would be overloaded and you wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah.
And then if your brain is able to process the information differently, I mean, some people are better at reading body language, correct?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So if you combine someone whose tools are better with their ability to process body language better, wouldn't they be more socially knowledgeable than other people?
Yeah, I agree. Some
I
people
like
are
theory.
Better.
I like this theory. I think it makes
like
the world
it
make a lot of sense.
Oh, good. Does anyone else have a problem with using the term on the spectrum? Don't you think that sounds derogatory?
Well, and that's what I was just thinking about this article. This article reveals that we need to stop seeing things like autism as a disability.
Yeah.
It's an ability, isn't it?
Maybe you're a superhuman. Yeah.
Also,
well,
no, this
I feel
is
like
Gary in the four in Alphas. This is exactly what Gary was like in Alphas.
He was on the spectrum.
No, he was autistic, but they had a superpower where he not only it was a brilliant character because his character was on the spectrum. He was autistic, but he also when he developed his alpha ability, he could see all the communication waves. So he could like hack anyone's cell phone just by using his mind. So they literally concretized his autism in an ability.
That's interesting. I just feel like on the spectrum can be shortened to something really derogatory sounding, like he's a speck.
Yeah, we've done this before.
Yeah. But I feel like it needs revisiting. Cause I mean, I'm not usually one of these politically correct people. Like, I don't know why we can't just say autism anymore, but we can't.
I think it's because there's different kinds.
Is this the greatest hits edition? Do I need to rename this?
But, yeah, I feel like we took a step back when we went with on the spectrum. Much like midgets going to little people. Feel like, step back for you there. Probably should go back to midgets. Anyway.
Well, speaking of things that people say have taken a step back, I review the season premiere of the last half season of Mad Men next in TV with JML. So Mad Men is finally bringing us its last few episodes here, and it's the end of an era for one of the greatest shows ever on television. The most recent episode aired last night, Sunday night, for whenever you listen to this podcast. It was called Severance. It focused on the question of what does it mean to live your life and live it to the fullest, which I think is been the theme of Mad Men for the whole series. So the episode opened with Don Draper seemingly propositioning this woman in a fur coat, giving her all these directions. She's standing in front of a mirror. And then it cuts to the song, Is That All There Is? So it's sort of saying, like, is this all there is to Don Draper? Is this all there is to humanity? And then it cuts to, obviously, this was part of them auditioning a model for an advertising pitch. But those were the two main thrusts of the whole episode. Is this all there is to life and to love? And the major thing that happened in this episode was there was a callback to season one, and there was a callback to one of the, as if this isn't an objectivist theme thing already, but one of the major objectivist themes in this show. So season one had this character, season one, two, called Rachel Menken, who is this stunningly beautiful Jewish woman who ran a department store. And she was shown as Don's equal. So even though Don was involved with this artist and he was involved with, you know, his wife, Betty, at the time, who was obviously not his equal, she was more his equal. So she was the Dagny to Don's Hank. Now, in the episode, Don found out that she died. He ends up going to, like, her wake or whatever. It was called a Shiva dinner. That's what they do in the Jewish culture. And talks to her sister. And her sister explains to him, she's like, what do you want? And he's like, I just want to know what her life was like. And she explains to him, she lived the life she wanted. So it's interesting that the character who was associated with good and the one sort of Dawn should have been with, the Dagny, lived the life she wanted. If that's not similar to a philosophy for living life on Earth, I don't know what is. And this was further backed up in the episode where Dawn took this really hard. He sort of tried to have some sort of weird relationship with this woman in a diner. And the episode ends with Don going back to the diner and the woman thinks he's going to try and like proposition her. There was sort of like accidental prostitution. Don't ask me how there's accidental prostitution. It was convoluted. It's besides the point. But he talks to her and she's like, well, what are you looking for? What's going on? And he explains the whole thing. And her response to him about Rachel Menken is, maybe you always loved her. Which has a lot of implications for the idea that Don could never live up and be the person, live up to the own image in his mind about the person he wanted to be. And also all the fact that he trades all these romantic partners is never satisfied with the woman he's with. Ultimately, is it because he's never satisfied with himself because he's not living the life he wants to live? So then the episode then ends with him just sitting there in the diner thinking, it's a slow pull-out shot, and it says, is that all there is? And the music plays again over the closing credits. Now also on the closing credits in the song, there's stuff about if there wasn't more, I would just end it now. And the waitress's name is Di. So you could come back with the theories that Don's ultimately going to commit suicide. But I just thought every once in a while, this show peeks through with sort of objectivist philosophy and it seems to have done it again.
I didn't know the show was still on.
Same here.
Remember that time we tried to watch the first episode and I fell asleep six times?
I had that same problem. When I watched the first three episodes, and I like to think it was because we were watching it in a situation that wasn't conducive. There was a whole bunch of people there and they were trying to have like a party, which is the last place you want to watch Mad Men. But I remember that as well, but I've gone back and watched it since, obviously, and I fell in love with it.
So the place you do want to watch Mad Men is a hospital that's out of Valium.
Yeah, by yourself, with the lights off. All that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Except you do need an air horn to go off every 30 seconds to make sure that you are following.
No. Do you have anything to say about the content of the episode?
Good improv there, Justin. Yes and. Yes and.
No. 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 No.
No, I mean, I appreciate your evaluation of the theme of this episode. I just can't get involved with this. I can't. I never have found any interest in this. I've even watched the parts where they show Atlas Shrugged, and I can't. I can't do it. There's something about it. Maybe it's the same way that I can't do Game of Thrones, that it is just so slowly paced that it's, look, I understand if a book is like that, because a book can use conceptual conversations and words and bring you through the descriptions. But if a TV show or a movie is like that, I feel like I'm being robbed of my time. Because there is something called an editor, and we have given him a position in the world. And his position is to take out the things that are unnecessary, that we don't need to see, the things that will make the story move.
But that's the brilliance of Mad Men, is that all those little things are significant, ultimately.
But there is something crow-blowing about trying to hold all of the significance of every minute detail. If this was ultimately an hour and 45-minute movie, I would say you could do that, where every single visual element has intense meaning. But this is a show that goes on over seasons. And that, in that regard, it's like War and Peace. It's just too much. It's crow blowing.
Yeah, it is crow blowing. I mean, I read reviews after I watch episodes, and they pick up all this really esoteric, and you know it's esoteric if I'm calling it esoteric. Then they pick up all this really esoteric stuff that I never would have thought of because I'm paying attention to all this other stuff. So the way I watch it is as follows. I essentialize around the theme. Which, you know, that's how you're supposed to watch a story. So when I see the beginning of the episode where it says, is that all there is? And there's talking about love and life. I'm not going to worry about the book the waitress has in her pouch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to worry about the Roger's mustache. Or I'm not going to worry about, one of the things they were talking about in this episode was a review I read in a Vulture review. That's what it's called, vulture.com. So Peggy's out to dinner with a date, a guy she was set up with, and he orders lasagna but gets veal by accident, and she convinces him to trade, and he's like, oh, you know, are you sure you're okay with it? And she says, yeah, I love veal. And they went into this whole analysis about how if you say I love veal a certain way, it sounds like I love you. So it's the brilliance of Mad Men's language, use of language again. Now, maybe they did that on purpose because they had that time to comb over the script. But if I'm watching the episode, that's not the essential of the scene. The essential of the scene is that he didn't order that. Peggy got upset with him and he said, well, what do I do now? Because if I give it back, I'm a jerk. Or if I complain, I'm a rude jerk customer. And if I don't care, if I don't complain, I'm a weak man. Which actually, by the way, that's relevant to the discussion we just had, correct?
Yeah.
So the fact that he convinces her that, hey, it's okay, and she goes with it, and she trades with him. That's what's important to the scene. She's learned to live the life that's in front of her and to love what's going on. That's important, not this small, minuscule thing.
Yeah, understandable. I don't know. I'll wait for the YouTube supercut.
Right. Or you can just listen to me every week, because the reason I'm tracking this is I think Mad Men's ultimate value will play out in the last episode the same way House's did. So because House ended up celebrating life and celebrating the main character and made him happy, it'll be interesting to see what they do with Don Draper, because it will be a stark statement on America, because it's a very similar character to House. So it'll be a stark statement on America and a stark statement on objectivism and on Don Draper himself and the entire series based upon how it ends. So I'm really intrigued from an intellectual standpoint to see how this story ends and if it actually has a good ending.
I think one of you guys should probably at this juncture explain to our listeners who may not be philosophically inclined as to what you mean by crow blowing, lest we get accused of bestiality.
So the short version is you have to think of it like, how much information can I actually retain in my head in one time and be able to integrate it all? So this comes from Ayn Rand, Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, and she gives an example about crows being able to hold a certain amount of information in her head, which is if one farmer goes into a field, the crow will wait until he comes out. If two go in, they'll wait till two come out. If three go in, they'll wait till three come out. But if four go in and three come out, they go into the field because they can't hold any more than that. It's any more than that just quote, blows their mind, blows the crow epistemology. Hope I did some justice to that. I haven't actually read that book in like 6 years.
Yeah, that's the basic idea. It's you can only hold a certain amount of information in your head. So if you try to have more, it blows your crow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good friend of ours, James, always wanted to have a t-shirt of a crow with a gun to its head, which I thought was a cute idea. don't above it. Don't, and then
yeah.
A gun. Yeah.
It's certainly liven up objectivist culture, so I approve.
Yeah, me too.
All right, so let's go into a couple more reviews here, but these are of newer shows. So those of us who are watching Community on Yahoo Screen have constantly seen the argument or the advertisements for Sin City Saints.
Sin City Saints, yeah. It's everywhere.
And I am marketing's bitch because I watched the entire season.
You are the specific person they were marketing to.
I know, because it was like, you're watching Community, but you're also a fan of new television shows, you'll give anything a chance, and it's sports?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this show, at all.
Do you watch Community on Yahoo Screen?
No.
That is why not.
It's the only place it advertises.
Correct.
Yeah.
So,
what's the general premise? I forget.
The general premise is a tech billionaire buys a NBA team in Las Vegas.
So it's about Mark Cuban.
Sort of. He's a bit younger and he's more of a party animal than Mark Cuban is because of course it's set in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole season is about how he mismanages the team and all of the things that go wrong. The first episode starts with, the star player that they drafted, a rookie who's making the team really good, is called Pope. So the mascot drives him in every game in a Pope mobile. Which is just a golf cart with him in it, like they surround him with like fake glass. So the owner decides to wear the mascot costume to drive him in the beginning of the episode. And what happens is when the star player, Ladarius Pope, gets out of the Pope mobile, the owner accidentally backs up into Ladarius Pope and hurts his knee. But then he drives off really quick or runs away really quick and they try to frame the mascot, which brings in the NBA league representative, mainly an Ackerman, who's very good in the role, as sort of like his foil and the typical, like, we don't really like each other, but we're going to end up liking each other dynamic. And it's about how they try to save the team based on all of these sort of ridiculous things that happen.
Have one full season out?
Yeah, they have one full season out. It's 8 episodes, so it's sort of like a full, you know, web series season, but they're full episodes. They're like 23 minutes. I think the strength of it is the cast. The cast really plays the material well, and I think they learned how to write for the cast better throughout the season. But the main thing it suffers from is they sort of do the Glee thing where they rush through plots. Like they had one whole episode which was about them trying to raise money to build a new arena, where that could be a season-long plot.
So this is the anti-Mad Men?
Yeah, it's the anti. Well, it is a sitcom, so it's sort of the anti-Mad Men, I guess, in that way, if you want to call it that. But I thought it was decent. I think it's worth checking out. I think it's better than a lot of things that are on television. But at the same time, just understand that, you know, the writing isn't amazing. They sort of rush through things. Although they do mention them in previous episodes, like, or in subsequent episodes. Like one episode, the main character, or the main... Not main character, the main point guard, Ladarius Pope, the star, while he's hurt, he's bored, he doesn't know what to do. So he meets a girl online, it seems like she's being catfished, but she really isn't catfishing him. But she dies because he didn't send her the money for a new liver, because everybody thought he was being catfished and didn't want to send the money. So they reference that in later episodes. So there is some funny creative stuff in it. And I think the best part about it is, because it's set in Las Vegas, it's entirely shot in Las Vegas. Because this is what I discovered with my research for it. It's done by Mandalay Sports Media, a new media company owned by presumably the people who own Mandalay Bay, which is probably why they were able to shoot it in Vegas. I'm sure they got deals everywhere. It has some really cool locations. For instance, they shoot one whole scene in the High Roller at night.
Oh, that's cool.
People who don't know, the High Roller is an observation wheel that rotates, and you go on it, and you can see over all of Vegas. Now, there's a major production error when they do that. There's one cut in it where obviously they were taken at two different times because there's no blue light on Maylene Ackerman's face, and then they cut real quick, and there is a blue light on her face, and you know they were shooting it, and they just didn't anticipate that because of all the lights that go all over Vegas.
Whoops.
So I really like the way it's shot, and that they have some really cool locations. And it's nice to see new locations because something actually isn't shot in Los Angeles, and you don't see a lot of stuff that actually use the character of the city of Las Vegas like that. So I did appreciate it for that.
So let's quickly play the if blank, then you'll like this show game.
Ooh, that's a tough one.
So like, you know, if you like sports comedies similar to...
Yeah, I was thinking about that. There aren't a lot of sports comedies on is the issue.
Is this like, what's the football one? The League. Anything like The League?
Yeah, it's sort of like The League. I mean, if you want to use two football metaphors, it's sort of like The League crossed with the movie The Replacements starring Keanu Reeves and Gene Hackman, which are two things I watched. So again, I was the prime audience for this.
I think you might be the only audience for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I wouldn't expect more of it, but I was impressed with the cast they got. I mean, they got Maylene Ackerman. They have Tom Arnold. They have Keiko O'Brien from Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Jesus, of course you're sold.
All right, so let's wrap up the
team. One last quick question. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is going to become a trend for cities? So we've already seen, like, Chipotle, a business, produce a television show to try to sell their sustainability nonsense. Are cities going to start producing content like this in order to sell themselves? Is this a giant advertisement for Las Vegas?
I mean, it sort of is because it's done by Mandalay Sports Media. I'm sure that's part of it. So I don't think this was quite Vegas, but I mean, we've sort of seen this where because of production is moving outside of Los Angeles, we see different cities becoming the centerpiece. You know, CSI New Orleans is actually shot down there in New Orleans. And we saw there was a web series with Michael Rooker. It was called like The Driving Dead or something like that, which was funded by a city in, I believe, Illinois or Indiana, one of those two.
Yeah, pretty much driving dead out there. Yeah. But I mean, like, Albuquerque, New Mexico has become a little bit of a tourist destination because of Breaking Bad. But in this case, the city of Las Vegas and the Mandalay Company in particular is financing this film almost as a way to purposely increase tourism, I would assume.
You know, it's funny that we're bringing this up because I was reading an article about the show. I like to watch, you know, home improvement shows, you know, because...
Procedural home improvement shows?
It's not a procedural. Shut up! No, but it's called Fixer Upper, and it's set in Waco. And the funny thing about it is that it has done a lot of, it's brought a lot of attention to Waco and to a lot of the beautiful neighborhoods and the old houses and everything there.
Yeah, that's what brought attention to Waco.
Yeah, and what's funny, for a new generation, yes, for those who don't know about, you know, cults and Janet Reno and all that, yeah. But it's funny because a lot of people started suspecting that the show was funded by the Waco local government, and they're saying, no, we don't get any money from the government at all, we're just privately produced for HGTV, but it's done a lot of promotion for Waco, and so now a lot of activities going on around that area.
So say to that, good. If television can turn us on to the fact that there are awesome, beautiful things in the world, and there are awesome, beautiful places to go in the United States, and everyone who says, I love traveling, doesn't say they have to travel to Europe or Africa or South America, good. Well done, television and film industry.
That's right. Go xenophobia.
That's not what I was saying. I was saying go love America.
No, I like it. Fuck other countries. I'm never leaving here.
Was it turnaround?
All right. Well, unfortunately, we had to leave a location this past week. We've been saying goodbye to a few shows on the podcast recently, And I want to say goodbye to a show that I love very much that people always sort of made fun of me for loving in the same way that Abed from Community was made fun of for loving. So I think this is sort of one of my similarities with Abed that I would be uncomfortable to admit. Cougar Town finally ended after 6 improbable seasons, which they in fact made fun of on their opening credits. So usually in the opening credits, they make a joke about the title or something about in the episode. And they finally changed the title in the final episode to Sunshine State. And then for the text under it, they said, "We finally got the title change," which is funny because it was the last episode. And then the last episode, it was a tearjerker, obviously, and it perfectly encapsulated what the show was. It was a group of friends all around Courtney Cox's character, and you thought one thing was happening, but at the end, another thing was happening. You know, she thought everyone was leaving her life, but really they were just giving her what she wanted for her birthday. She said it's sad you never get to attend your own funeral because you don't get to hear the nice things people have to say about you. So the whole episode was about how everyone pretended they were leaving to make up an excuse to tell her character Jules how they felt about her and how awesome she was. And then the episode ended with them all standing in the cul-de-sac with her son, Travis, and her friend, who's Travis's girlfriend now, Lori, deciding to move into the cul-de-sac. So it's sort of like they will always be friends and they will always be together, that group of people, which is what the show was, and that's how the show should end. So people always say there aren't good series finales. You are wrong. I tip my hat to you, Cougar Town. You're a great show, severely underrated, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that you saddled yourself with a bad name.
Always thought this was a Discovery Channel show.
Right, because no one's made a joke about the name. Do you guys have anything else to say about the show?
Much like Meerkat Manor.
Meerkat Manor.
Never watched an episode, although, ironically, did know this was on the air, did not know Mad Men was still on the air. So... kudos to you, Cougar Town Marketing Department. This show took a dramatic turn after season one. Is that correct?
It was pretty much actually in the middle of season one, where it started out where it was like, Jules is a cougar, and across the town there's Grayson, or across the street there's Grayson who moves in, or, no, he was, I don't remember if he moved in or not. No, I don't think he moved in. But across the street is Grayson, who's the womanizing older man. So it was contrasting their two lifestyles. But then it realized, wait, this show is much more compelling if we put them together as two broken people trying to make it work rather than trying to have them apart and have this weird commentary on older men womanizing versus older women meninizing.
By men. Well, congrats to you, Cougar Town, for making money for so long. We will miss you. Justin will. I never knew thee.
So, moving from Floridian wine drinkers to California wine drinkers, it's time for Reddit on Reddit.
Sony, stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA blows, Steam rocks, got Res form on Firefox. These things are all on Reddit, mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit, no we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit, and this is one of these Reddit shower thoughts. California produces a lot of wine, but is in the middle of a bad drought. What California needs is a reverse Jesus. Thoughts, gentlemen?
That sounds like a sexual position. I don't know about you.
I had the same reaction. I thought complicated, dirty sexual position.
Yeah, reverse Jesus.
Yeah.
Right after the dirty Carl.
The dirty Carl? Not the dirty Sanchez.
Whatever it is. The hot Carl, sorry. The hot Carl,
get it
the dirty
right.
Sanchez into the reverse Jesus. Reverse Jesus.
Pittsburgh steamer. Oh, God. Don't even want to think about those things. This is clever. You know, we could just desalinate the motherfucking ocean.
How long until they regulate the wine production because it takes away from the water?
Yeah, I mean, it's already fairly regulated. I mean, not as badly as water, ironically.
But how long until we just set California adrift in the ocean?
Yeah. Hey.
No, you'll have already moved to Austin, Texas with me, or to D.C. with Daniel.
No, we're going to all move to Austin because D.C. fucking blows.
Yeah, but, well, in 2 years.
I thought the funniest reply to this thread was somebody on Reddit said that, so you're saying California needs the Antichrist?
Actually, they do. They do in a certain sense, just not in the way they mean. I think they need, drum roll please, Justin, Ayn Rand.
Yes, and this backs up what we were saying earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just do the fucking logical thing. $1 a day. $1 a day.
I mean, Ayn Rand, if we're going to have a literal human figure who is the Antichrist, pretty much, right?
Yeah, but I would hesitate to do that because that gives too much credence to all those people who say, well, objectivism is just Satanism.
Well, I mean, just because you're anti-Christ doesn't mean you are Satan. Different things here.
Well, that's the problem with the denotation versus the connotation of the word Antichrist.
Yeah, but I mean, Jew, woman, from Russia, promoted selfishness, atheist. Come on. It's about as opposite as you're going to get.
Yeah, if you're taking denotatively the word, but literally, well, that's literally, but I mean connotatively, connotatively they mean the devil when they say Antichrist.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's how people get to Ayn Rand and Satanism are the same thing. Objectivism and Satanism are the same thing.
Did you ever see that horrible cartoon online where Jesus is showing off at a party, turning water to wine, and then he accidentally touches someone's arm and turns all of the water in their body to wine?
No,
and
that's
like,
funny.
Like freak out, like start twitching, and Jesus is like, oh, they've got about 8 seconds to live.
That's funnier than the South Park version of it. I always love the South Park version of it, where he puts water on the table, and then he goes, okay, turn around, turn around, turn around. And then the Jesus action figure for South Park comes with a pitcher of water and a pitcher of wine.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All right.
Yeah.
Next Reddit. Parents withdraw teen from college after spring break video shows him biting off a hamster's head. So I have a question for Elliot based upon this.
For me?
Okay. Elliot, isn't this more of a farce to witness? You said all the farce had been witnessed.
No, I don't think so. I think we hit our peak with the girl trying to kill her mother for taking away her iPhone. I think that edges this story out a little bit.
That was peak farce.
That was the peak. So
really,
let's be honest. Ozzy did.
She's going to kill her mother because she took her iPhone away. You can't top that.
Ozzy did it already. That taking a week off from school meant that he would just bite a hamster's head off, and then the parents' punishment for him was to take him out of the only decent thing he's doing, going to class.
Wait, faulty premise.
Yeah, that assumes he goes to class.
not to mention the faulty premise that going to college is a good thing.
He might be better out of college.
So he's just watching Ozzy Osbourne videos, saw him bite the head off a bat, and was like, fuck it, I got a hamster.
You know what I would do if this were my kid? You know how I would punish him?
Keep away your pets?
No. I would quit my job and go to school with him to make sure he was doing nothing but go to school.
It's interesting. I prefer a much more old school parenting method, like if your parents caught you smoking, and so they make you smoke the whole pack right there in front of him.
Just
make him bite the head off like 40 hamsters until he's sick
of
it. Oh. We're like the Native Americans. We don't waste any part of the hamster.
Yeah. Finish that hamster.
A hamster sandwich.
He'll be on Food Network, 100 different ways to cook hamster. Have a frying pan, a little wok, a little oil, and some orange glaze. And
if he actually wanted to eat hamster,
cream friche,
I would be okay with it.
It's true.
But how do you get to the point? How are we to the point in our society that spring break is now this?
Spring break, woo! Meet you down at Senior Tadpole's where they make margaritas in your mouth. Where's that from, gentlemen?
That is Arrested Development.
Yes! Thank you.
That's an easy one. But that didn't answer my question.
Okay, look.
Yeah, you got a question?
We're at a point in a culture where it's just sort of like, it's like action movies, right? Where the first action movie, you're like, that's good action. They had a plot. It's interesting. But then when they make a sequel, they have to like ramp up the action 33%. So the next one, you're like, whoa, that was a lot of fucking action. A little less plot. Number three, one giant explosion for 2 hours. That's where we are in culture right now.
You say that, but
ramp it up.
Fast and the Furious 7, Furious 7, had the biggest box office opening of any of the previous movies in that franchise.
I believe it, but what I've heard from the reviews is one giant fucking explosion.
Well, what I heard is it's very emotional because they deal with Paul Walker's death. That's what
I've heard. That's at the end. They put him in a white car and kick it and he runs off. That's it.
Is that what it is? Did you just spoil the movie? You didn't even drop a spoiler warning.
Nope. Don't want anyone to see it.
Well, apparently everyone is seeing it, so. Maybe that's your answer to this next question, Daniel.
Yeah. Let's go.
Next Reddit. Final Reddit. If you could have one statistic displayed above everyone's head, what would it be? For you, Daniel, would it be how many Fast and the Furious movies they've seen?
Right. If it's a zero, best friend. If it's like a five or higher, fucking skeptical.
We need there to be 10 Fast and the Furious movies, so we can say what are they on a scale of 1 to 10, and just completely destroy everyone's mind because they won't know what you're talking about. She's a 1. Yeah. I want to date her. What?
Yes, exactly. That's fucking awesome. No, I mean, I think this is actually a quasi-interesting slash Naziistic question. Jew or not? I think that's an interesting question. Someone, their first answer on Reddit was their degree of separation from you. Which I actually think is kind of interesting. That would be useful-ish. You could start off conversations with people. Sort of like LinkedIn on your head.
Yeah, but LinkedIn never makes sense. Cause how do you
Cause
you connect with people and then you're like, oh, well, I'm not really connected with that person, so I'm not really connected with this person by 3 degrees. So how are you gonna define your connectedness with somebody with this statistic?
Just, you know, like, if it's a 3, that means there's only one person between you and them.
So that tells me who to kill?
No! If you, like, okay, I see. Really? No.
You made that one too easy.
So I guess you would also have to know who the one or what the separation chain is. Because if it's like, oh, how do you know Elliot? I know Elliot. Then it's a good conversation starter. But if it's just a 3 and you have no idea, be like, do you know Elliot? Do you know Justin? Do you know Luke? Do you know James? Do you know Jonathan? Do you know Jackie? Et cetera, et cetera.
So basically you want people's Facebook friends list now on their head every day.
Yeah, number of Facebook friends I thought of. But that's not really indicative of anything. Although, Twitter followers? No, same problem.
I just want to know I want to know how many books a person's read. Like, you know, because people talk about, you know, especially, and because if you're walking down, like, New York, you know, like in Brooklyn or any of these hipster places, and they're all talking about these books that they've read, you know, if you were to actually, like, find out the truth, they've never actually read these books. They just skimmed the back of them, or they read like the cliff notes. They never actually read them. So I'd be very curious to see how many full novels or nonfiction works you've actually read, as opposed to what you pretend to have read.
What if we tweak this a little bit? Because I like that concept, but I don't like the idea of the number, because then it's going to become like, you know, you're judging people solely by the number, right? So it's not the quality. It won't be the quality of books read. It'll be the quantity, right? So
I've read all of the Harlequin romance novels.
Yeah. I mean, I've read every Boxcar Children book there is from the time I was a kid, but like, that's because I read those 30, that counts. You get what I'm saying?
I love the Boxcar Children. I remember reading the first book as a kid. You know, like when the younger sister Violet gets sick and then they have to go get help, and it turns out that the grandfather that they were afraid of was actually like really, you know, loved them and was worried about them. It was such a good book. Sorry.
I don't disagree with you. I
don't know if that was hilarious or if Justin's secretly gay.
They're good books for kids.
Column C.
But,
okay. I don't think Justin would secretly be gay. Like, if he were gay, I think he would just admit it from the front.
He'd be very gay.
No, like, I'd admit it
like
from
violently
behind.
Gay.
You admit it from behind.
Because I'm like, I don't think he would be flaming.
He would be like pop punk gay.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm fucking gay. You want to fight about it?
So you're telling me I'd be the lead singer of Fireworks? That's what you're telling me?
Katy Perry? What?
No, the band Fireworks. That was a really obscure pop punk reference.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, moving on.
My point is, what if instead of the number, because we don't want people to get obsessed with that, what if it was just like an indication of if they're saying they read something or see or saw something, that it actually tells you if they did or not, like lying or not.
Ah, an aesthetic lie detector.
But only having to do with the arts?
Well, I don't know. I just was taking his thing. I mean, we could apply that outwards.
So when people are like, I've read, she's like totally terrible. And right, it's like, no, you haven't.
But you haven't. You lie. Lie.
Right.
That's interesting.
When you ask Christians, you know, have you read the Bible? Yes, I've read the Bible. And then, nah.
Which is with anything they say, right?
So, I have a interesting thought here that something that's actually come up on the Adam Carolla show. Shock and awe. He thinks that, everyone should have a number. Every man should have a number. And it has to do with a combination of both your penis length and girth.
So you could actually going next.
Do a water displacement test, not yeah. just a measurement, but a water displacement test. And then everyone gets a windbreaker with their number on it. And then 1 month out of the year, you have to wear that windbreaker.
Why? Why does he think they should have to do that? Because I was going to say we could do a similar thing like penis size or like number of people slept with. What does he think the advantage of that windbreaker is?
He thinks it's a conversation starter.
That's it?
Yeah. I mean, he thinks there would be like endorsement deals eventually. Like, can you imagine if you're someone with a number like, and by the way, it's rank. So it's not actual size or whatever. It's just rank in the world.
Oh, that's better.
Yeah, sorry, that's a key element to it. Rank in the world.
Yeah, that's better.
So like, if you see someone with like like in triple digits even, you're like, holy fuck! That's scary.
Okay, but can we do this for women? I mean, can they do like a clay, like mold of like their inside so that people can see if there's tread on the tires or if it's just a pencil in the hallway kind of
wow,
thing?
Wow, madam, you have a cavernous vagina. I'm not sure it would work quite the same.
Yeah.
At least men would proudly or ashamedly wear their windbreakers, whereas women I think would just be confused. As to why
would the dude who got the windbreaker 69 be like the happiest dude in the world? Because he'd have the number 69, but
also,
he'd also be ranked 69?
Very interesting debate on their show is, at what number would you, at, like what cutoff number would you be proud to wear your jacket? Like, and wear it around, like, you know, strutting it around.
Well, I think if your number would be considered high in Asia, then you would be proud, right? So if you're above all the Asian numbers, then you're good. Right? Is that
but
how
like,
it works?
Yeah, I mean, if you think all the men in the world, right? We're talking, okay, but 18 or older, obviously.
Well, right, that's
not,
the other
we're
question.
Not creepy.
Do they issue you windbreakers every year?
Yeah, it's ranked every year based on the new incoming 18-year-olds. So, like, there's always some young whippersnapper who might, you know.
It's like, fuck, this is the year LeBron turns 18. Damn it!
Exactly. The numbers are skewed! Yeah. So, like, what's the cutoff number? Because we're talking billions, or maybe a billion, let's say, eligible men.
Well, there's more than a billion eligible men. I mean,
you're fine, I think.
What?
If you're somewhere in the top million of a billions of people, then I think you should be proud.
It's going to be more than the top million to be proud. I think it's a little bit of that gay culture shining through there.
Size queen over here.
Jeez. A million out of a billion? That's a low percentage.
Top 10 million at least.
But it's more than a billion men on the planet.
You've got to be eligible, so. I don't know. Anyway, this is one of the fun stories that sort of tied over to our show.
For a show with two straight men and only one gay man, we talk a lot about wangs on this show.
Well, I mean, that's the one thing gay guys and straight guys can agree upon. Penises are awesome.
Yeah.
Yes,
we like to talk about them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that crosses sexual boundaries, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think that's something that men, women, and gay men can agree on. The only people who are left out of this are lesbians.
Yeah. And, don't fuck them. See what I did there? Okay.
Yeah. Alright, let's move on now to our favorite segment. Join us as we name a narcissist. I'd rather die than let you ever get away with this. You are the
antithesis, narcissist. This kiss could be upon my own lips. I'd rather die.
Well, it just wouldn't be a podcast if we didn't talk about rape. At least in this case, it's not a real rape, it's a fake rape that Rolling Stone claimed was a real rape. Rolling Stone reporter Sabrina apologized after her Rolling Stone story about the UVA fraternity rape case was found out to be completely made up and false. But she didn't apologize to the people who were actually falsely accused, the UVA fraternity. In a statement to the New York Times and others, she said, "I want to offer my deepest apologies to Rolling Stone's readers, to my Rolling Stone editors and colleagues, to the UVA community, and to any victims of sexual assault who may feel fearful as a result of my article." I won't read the rest of the apology, but it reads like a Barack Obama speech. She says the word "I" and "my" about 50,000 times in three paragraphs, and talks about how her life has been so difficult these past few months, you know, being a reporter at this. So I think this woman is a definite narcissist. She thinks this entire thing is about her and is only concerned with her feelings, her attitudes, her editors. It couldn't be any more disgusting, in my opinion.
I would like to be the first to congratulate the fraternity in question on their huge, wonderful purchase of Rolling Stone magazine through the lawsuit that they will assuredly win. And if they're looking for any writers or contributors, the three of us will nominate ourselves.
Can a whole group sue one magazine like this? Is that possible?
Yeah.
I think so. Phi Kappa Psi, as an incorporated business, could sue for defamation. Libel, I think, actually. Libel.
They're going to own it in that magazine.
Because they libeled members of it, they can say the entire organization's been... libeled.
Well, the organization has been, has been libeled. Yeah, there are many reports of people who no longer donate to the fraternity, for instance, because they said that they were unapologetic rapists.
They suspended
them on campus, which lost out members. UVA, a school, could sue Rolling Stone because they've gotten letters from prospective students saying, "I refuse to go to the school that allows such rapists to exist on campus." So there are many people in this, and especially the specific members who were accused of this have tremendous lawsuits waiting, certainly.
My question is, why are we still protecting Jackie's identity? This girl Jackie, the one that made these accusations, nobody is reporting her name, anything like that, even though these accusations have been proven to be hogwash. Why are we still protecting her identity? Why can't we know who she is and have her face judgment?
Because if we do that, it makes it so women will never want to report rapes, right? I mean, that's what I've been told as a male, that we can't do that because that's shaming accusers.
Well, we should be shaming liars, false accusers.
I agree. I was being sarcastic.
No, I know. But I'm just saying, like, it's just ridiculous.
It's very interesting. It blows my mind, and I don't know why it does, but it still does, that this woman, this writer, Sabrina Erdely, couldn't give a sincere apology to the people she accused of being rapists.
Well, this is your crow being blown, which shows that you're on the spectrum. Because you empathize too much with the guys. I'm only partially kidding.
It's definitely, my crow is blown, like, just fucking deep-throated. It's terrible.
This is what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about people who are dumber just don't understand as much. She has internalized this role of journalist where she thinks she didn't do anything wrong. She thinks she's disconnected from the rest of the human race.
Yeah. She doesn't believe that she's actually falsely accused of. She's one of those reporters, activists, journalists who think that because even though it was false in this particular circumstance, it's still true everywhere else. So the fact that it was false doesn't matter to her. It's beside the truth or the falsehood of the story, falseness, falsity, whatever. The truth of the story is besides the point. The point is the cause. The point is the attention for all of the women that she thinks are being raped on a daily basis on college campuses everywhere.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Because at Iowa Hawk, David Burge tweeted earlier something along those lines. He said, "Modern journalism in a nutshell, what a story, quote, tells us is far more important than whether or not it's true."
Right, because they figure, oh, well, you're going to get some stuff wrong sometimes, but as long as you're right in the broader sense, that's what matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. This reminds me very much of when I was applying for grad school and I got waitlisted at a very prestigious journalism master's program because, and they called me and said, we would admit you today except that your statement of purpose is about objectivity in journalism and we think that's an insanely dated notion. Are you willing to reconsider that? And we would give you acceptance right now over the phone. And I thought it was a joke.
Yeah, it's like, are you recording this right now? Like, are you trying to fuck over my entire career before it starts?
It's like, Bob Saget? What are you? Yeah. And it was not a joke. We had about an hour long discussion where I tried to tease out of them that there was something to objectivity in journalism. And they were adamant that it was an outdated notion. There's no such thing and we shouldn't strive for it.
And what were they saying was the purported goal?
The reported goal is to give some insight into humanity,
yeah.
Not to give any objective truth, give some thing that you can chew on that might be true from multiple perspectives or from a given point of view.
Right, but if there's no objective point of view and you're giving them insight, you can only be giving them your own insight. So these reporters become like renegade assholes, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, what about good old-fashioned accuracy? I mean, even if objectivity is a thing of the past, even if you're going to work for a publication, a newspaper, a magazine that writes from a specific point of view, you still have to be accurate in what you're writing. So is that gone away? So is
accuracy is a cognate of objectivity. If there's no such thing as objective truth, well, then nothing can be accurate either.
But are they talking about, like, objective as in impartiality? Or objective as in their evaluation of reality?
Both.
What do they mean?
I think epistemologically these people aren't as radical as philosophers, for instance. So I think they might say that epistemologically there might be truth, we just can't know it. Like, because we're fallible. Their main thing was that you can never know what really happened. That was their whole point. As journalists, we weren't there. So we can never know what really happened. So we have to abandon trying to be objective and more so just try to give a perspective that could be true under certain circumstances.
Right, so it's both.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which wow. I told them on the phone then and there, I will not be attending your school. I will not be encouraging anyone to attend your school ever. So.
You should name, who is it? Tell us now.
It was Northwestern. Journalism school, Medill School of Journalism.
All right, that? Well, that's what we learned this week, huh?
There you go, listeners. If you go to Northwestern.
Yeah. All right. What did we learn this week, Daniel?
Well, I learned that there is a pretty obvious solution to the California water crisis, which is someone needs to look at a goddamn map, really. Is all there is.
Elliot?
I learned that Mad Men is still on the freaking air. I didn't know it was on the air, man.
Not much longer. Not much longer.
What did you learn, Justin?
I learned that we need to redefine our definitions of intelligence and emotional intelligence and really consider if those are opposites. What do we mean by socially intelligent? What do we mean by emotionally intelligent? I don't think we properly define those words.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, if you learned something, why don't you tweet us at The Midside or leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheMidside, or visit themidside.com/podcast for all the latest episodes. Thanks so much for your fantastic iTunes reviews. Seriously, you make us blush. But we're trying to grow this show, so just tell a friend. Tell two friends. Tell your mom. Tell your dog. Anyone who can download it on iTunes or listen to it through themidside.com/podcast or through Pulp Epic. Any of those. Listen. Share. Thanks.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Well, speaking of things that people think have taken a step back. Did anyone ever say spec back?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, that's offensive. That's like the N-word.
All right, let me take that again.